This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Upjohn Institute researcher Michelle Miller Adams discusses the Kalamazoo Promise, its imitators, and President Obama's plan for free community college. But first, in honor of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we look back at his visit to Western Michigan University in December of 1963. In 2013, WMUK's Erlene McMichael spoke with Western's retired vice president for student affairs, Tom Coyne.
Mr. Thomas Coyne, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You were present at Dr. Martin Luther King's address here at Western Michigan University 4 months after he gave his historic I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. What was your role here at Western at that time?
At that time, I was the director of alumni relations, and I was the advisor to the senior class. That's a significant thing in terms of its background.
Give me that background.
The background of Dr. King's speech is, I think, sometimes overlooked, and unfortunately overlooked, because he came at a very significant time in world history, U.S. history, not to mention the history of Western Michigan University. In 1963, as the school year began, the senior class was a very active group, much more active than we realized. And I've realized it when I received a phone call one morning from President James W. Miller, asking me why was Governor Ross Barnett of the state of Mississippi being invited to speak at the Western Michigan University campus, which he had just announced. And I said, I didn't know a thing about it. He said, the senior class has apparently invited him. I told the president I'd find out what I could immediately and did. Turned out that the senior class, a very active group of young men and women, led by President Tom Ruschkamp, had decided that they wanted to have significant speakers on the campus. And so they contacted by mail some 30 figures who were in the news. One of those figures in the news, very much in the news, was the voice of the leading face, so to speak, of segregation in the United States, Governor Ross Barnett of Mississippi. He had, in the year previous, tried to deny the enrollment of James Meredith to the University of Mississippi. He was clearly one of the most rabid segregationists in the country. But he was in the news, so the students wanted to hear him speak. And he accepted. Of all the 30 that were sent, he's the only one who accepted. And the president, James Miller, took a great deal of heat, great deal of pressure from local people, the local heads of the NAACP, local government officials, and then up into the state level, including up into Governor Romney's office.
I'm sorry, were you the senior class advisor?
I was the advisor.
But you didn't know that they had done this.
I was blindsided entirely. I was very, very much surprised by this. But the president said, this is a student's invitation. They have the right to hear a speaker on this campus. He will come on according to our regulations, which mean that he will be subject to question and answer period. But I am not going to deny the students the right to bring in a speaker. This is a university. And he saw it as a teachable moment. And so even though he took a tremendous amount of pressure, including threats to cut university funding, lots of anger, he stood by the students, even though he had been blindsided as badly as I had. And as a result, Barnett came and spoke on campus. But because of his speech, a number of our leading faculty members, led by Dr. Sam Clark, who was the founder of the Honors College, wanted to have other speakers on the other dimensions of this whole civil rights issue. And they set up a speaker series called The Conscience of America. And one of the first speakers that they wanted to get, of course, was Dr. Martin Luther King. Dr. King accepted, and although the first date that he was supposed to come, he was not able to come, he did arrive in December and did give his speech at the Fieldhouse. Unfortunately for Dr. King, he arrived in the midst of a raging snowstorm, which greatly reduced the attendance. We probably only had about 2,000 people in attendance. And
what's the capacity of the field house?
The capacity of the field house, the way they had it set up at that time, would have been about 5,000. Dr. King came and presented the leading speech in this Conscience of America series. He was, I think, finally the only speaker who did come. But he gave a very measured address. I thought at the time, I think at the time still, that he was very grave, almost somber in his approach. He did not have in his talk the glowing eloquence that he used in the Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech that we hear so much about. And part of that, you know, was because in Washington, he deviated from his regular speech. That was an add-on that he put in at that moment. And I think Dr. King's memorable speeches are when he did that, when he moved into his I am a preacher mode, and he spoke from the heart to the people who were there as a preacher, as a teacher. But at Western, he was more on track, so to speak, more on target. And he was fairly somber. He was really probably more effective even in his question and answer period.
What stands out to you as someone who was there listening to him give this speech?
I remember a couple of things. One, I remember the delight of Sam Clark and President James Miller. They had now someone to speak in contradiction and an explanation of this whole issue of civil rights versus segregation. I remember President Miller's initial comments to the students and to the audience present that the logical course of analysis is action. And Dr. King had been showing that action throughout the country in his efforts for civil rights. And he wanted that to be a lesson that the students would learn as well, that education was a sham unless it was a question of their taking that education and transforming it into an action. I remember Dr. King's very measured comments in response to the questions that he was given afterwards. He was particularly attentive. You could see him thinking clearly, what do I want to respond to this question?
You say that he was very measured in his responses to the questions, but you felt that he did, that it was more impactful, the question and answer period.
Yes.
Tell me what's the content of that you felt was so impactful?
One, his speech was a speech about the conscience of America. So he was trying to give a broad overview. The question that stands out most clearly in my own mind, because it really was prophetic, not only about what he was talking about, but as it turned out, his own life. Dr. King was asked in one of the very last questions, what would be the impact of President Kennedy's death on the movement for civil rights and the civil rights bill? Because President King had been assassinated.
This is just weeks after
Kennedy had been assassinated November. So King made a point of saying, and he had talked to, I presumed on this issue, a number of times with President Johnson, that he thought that it was not unlikely that the movement would, the bill would go ahead and be successful, and that in fact President Kennedy might have been more successful after his death than he was before.
Why is that?
And when you realize it and you look at the impact of Dr. Martin Luther King himself after his assassination, and the impact that he had had on a number of individuals who have followed him and who have stepped into his footsteps, you begin to see that he really, although not, I'm sure, consciously, was reflecting his own life.
So would you agree that the movement advanced greater because of the deaths of these two men?
I very definitely do. I think that...
Why do you say that?
I think that President Kennedy, with his assassination, again, achieved an almost mythic stature. But what he was fighting for, and at that time he was fighting for it, President Kennedy moved slowly into the civil rights movement. He did not move rapidly. He was pushed along by men like Harris Wolford and his brother Bobby, brother Teddy. But he was he was conscious of the forthcoming election in 64. He'd had a very narrow election in 60. And so he was moving with a certain amount of political caution that his advisors, Harris and Bobby and Teddy, were not really willing to get. They wanted to move much more quickly, and so did the civil rights leaders. But he was moving. Now he was moving in that direction, and it was known that he was moving in that direction. And as a result, when President Johnson came into office, he immediately took up those challenges and brought them forward in President Kennedy's name. And he was able to do, using Kennedy's example, Kennedy's martyrdom, so to speak, as a way of forcing the American people to say, now we have to rise up and meet the challenge of our dead president.
Thank you, Mr. Coyne, for joining us.
Tom Coyne is retired from Western Michigan University. He spoke with WMUK's Erlene McMichael in 2013.
Sometimes a man does more in his death than he could have ever done in life. And sometimes we must, in history, take an evil situation and wring the good out of it.